Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 27th of December. Our main stories: as their diplomatic row deepens, Mexico says it's taking Bolivia to court over the intimidation of its diplomats. The Iranian security forces have been patrolling Tehran and other cities to try to prevent widespread protests. And Sudan has formally apologised to its Christians for the way they were mistreated during decades of rule by Omar al-Bashir. Also in the podcast, Turkey's constitutional court rules that the Turkish ban on Wikipedia is unconstitutional. And later,
it's a matter of actually, if you like, spreading your risk. Leave some where they are, but you relocate some to other locations that are secure.
British troops help move critically endangered black rhinos to Malawi to protect them from poachers. The sanctity of embassies around the world is something nations take very seriously. In fact, diplomatic missions are protected by the 1961 Vienna Convention. Mexico says Bolivia is violating that treaty by deploying large numbers of police and intelligence officers outside the Mexican embassy in the Bolivian capital, La Paz, and says it will take its case to court. However, as he announced that legal action, Mexico's foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, said his country would not be intimidated.
Tenemos 10,000 mexicanas y mexicanos.
We have 10,000 Mexican men and women in Bolivia that we have to attend to. And at the embassy, there are 9 people who have applied for asylum under international law. So we are not going to withdraw our staff, nor do we plan to do so.
The two nations have been at loggerheads since Mexico granted asylum to the Bolivian ex-president Evo Morales after he was forced to resign in the face of mass protests. Our Mexico correspondent Will Grant is monitoring events at the Mexican embassy in Bolivia.
It is an absolute ramping up of the outside the building, and not just the embassy in La Paz, but also the ambassador's residence. Some of the people inside the building have posted pictures, for example, of policemen milling around outside the building, standing on guard, and also sort of on a hillside, seemingly a group of policemen being watched. So the Mexican side of this equation, these policemen are basically there to scare and make staff uncomfortable and whoever may be inside seeking asylum.
And will this end up in court, or is it just part of their wider war of words?
It's hard to say. I think at this stage, it does seem like a war of words. This is a ongoing spat over the fact that Mexico first offered asylum to ex-president Evo Morales and helped him leave the country when he resigned at the request of the military. Mexico, too, has been sort of taking its time to recognise the interim government in Bolivia, which has annoyed the transitional government there and the interim president. So, you know, there's a variety of elements to this. The idea that it ends up in The Hague seems at this stage to be quite far-fetched, but, you know, it certainly has the potential to when the Bolivian response has been, well, we'll see you in court.
And has Bolivia itself become more stable since that disputed election, or are the disputes still continuing there?
I mean, I feel like it's not particularly stable. It's stable in the sense that there are fewer headlines about tear gas flying from one side and stones being thrown from the other. You know, that has calmed down. But politically, I feel that it's still very volatile. It's certainly not a stable country in South America as things stand at the moment.
Will Grant in Mexico City. It has been 40 days since hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in Iran, protesting against a rise in petrol prices and calling for greater political freedom. The government response saw hundreds of people killed in what was seen as the bloodiest crackdown since the revolution. More than a month on from that unrest, tensions remain high. Security forces have been patrolling the streets and internet access has been restricted. The clampdown was particularly tight on Thursday for the 40-day anniversary of the killings, as I heard from Kazra Naji of the BBC Persian service.
Shiite Muslims marked the 40th day, usually with the gathering of family and friends, usually by the graveside or at the mosque or at home. They mark it. So today, being the 40th, the authorities expected there would be a lot of people out on the streets causing trouble for them, protesting. That's why security forces were out in big numbers across the country, and they They blocked roads to cemeteries. They arrested people for organizing gatherings. They threatened the families of the dead not to hold memorial services. And we've had so many videos from many cities across the country showing these revolutionary guards wearing black with balaclavas on motorcycles, wielding guns and batons, roaming the streets of these cities just as a show of force.
Yeah, a serious crackdown. Does this show that the authorities are worried and that they have a reason to be worried?
They have a reason to be worried. People are very angry. The people have never seen this kind of thing before. So many dead in the last month. We had at least 300 people killed, according to Amnesty International. But there are other sources who put the number to close to 1,500 so far. And this number is going up because there are more reports coming in.
So it's 40 years since the Islamic Revolution and 10 years since the authorities were challenged in those big protests in 2009. How does this compare to those occasions?
The violence is unprecedented. We haven't seen this before. So many people in such a short space of time being killed, with security forces having orders, seemingly a shoot to kill at demonstrators. We had a top commander of Revolutionary Guards today, as others in Iran, they've been blaming agitators, troublemakers, agents of foreign powers for this. But this Revolutionary Guard commander was saying that, the enemy, in inverted commas, is concentrating on the poor, which is a reference to the fact that these demonstrations are driven by the poor, the very people in whose name 40 years ago they made this revolution, which is basically a reflection of how this revolution 40 years on is completely and utterly failed.
Kasra Naji on events in Iran. Over the border in Iraq, the Iraqi president Barham Saleh has refused to name a pro-Iranian politician as prime minister, saying he would rather resign than appoint someone who would be rejected by protesters. In a letter to Parliament, Mr. Saleh said he would not ask the governor of Basra province, Assad al-Aidani, the candidate of the pro-Iranian bloc, to form a government. The previous Iraqi prime minister resigned last month after anti-government protests left hundreds dead. Joanna Sabah from BBC Monitoring explained the background to my colleague Divya Arya.
There's actually a bit of tension in parliament between these two major political factions, both of which claim to have the majority, one of which seems to have sided with the protest movement and the other is more of a pro-Iran like a coalition. It's mostly representing armed militias, which have become very powerful in the country. And they've put forth the governor of Basra in the south as their third nominee for the post of prime minister in a bid to sort of, it's not really a power grab, but just to safeguard whatever influence that they can within the political system right now. And this candidate has been rejected by the protesters, as have the ones before him. So now the president is threatening to resign, essentially in protest over this, and he's telling them that whoever is chosen as a candidate for prime minister needs to be representative of the protesters.
And remind our global listeners about why the protest started in the first place and what is the situation right now?
So there have been successive protests in Iraq virtually over the past 2 years, and they mostly have been over lack of job opportunities, lack of basic services and so on. But then the protest movement that started in October, it began over these issues, these various sporadic issues, but it sort of expanded to try to address, I suppose, the root cause of these issues, which is rampant corruption throughout the political establishment in Iraq. And the fact that much of this political establishment is very much loyal to Iran on the one hand, often at the expense of the Iraqi people. And, you know, there's all this like political infighting, often, you know, at the expense of actually getting things done in Iraq, which has left many people, you know, without job opportunities, without these services and so on. So basically people feeling very much disenfranchised.
And more than 450 people have died in these protests, which have turned violent in bits and parts, especially since October. This offer of resignation by the Iraqi president, how do the protesters see it?
It's too soon to say. I think in general, they have also rejected the candidate that was put forth for prime minister. His name is Asad al-Aydani. He is the governor of Basra, which has actually been the site of various protests just over the past 2 years, especially in the summer months. And like in summer this year, they were suffering from major water pollution and the lack of basically drinkable water, as well as lack of electricity, lack of other basic services. And Aydani responded with quite a brutal crackdown against the protests earlier this year. So in general, the protesters are very much opposed to these candidates, and they're opposed to the political factions putting them forward.
Joanna Sabah talking to Divya Arya. 71 migrants have been rescued trying to get to the UK by crossing the English Channel in small boats. Most are now in Britain after the Coast Guard led an operation to pick them up. More than 1,700 migrants have already crossed over the Channel in small boats this year. Jonathan Josephs reports.
At 1:30 in the morning, the emergency services were alerted to four small boats in the English Channel. It's likely the relatively calm weather overnight encouraged them to make the crossing from France to Britain. This group included 48 men and women and one child. They said they had fled from Afghanistan, Iran and Iraq. They were intercepted and taken ashore in two Coast Guard cutters and a lifeboat. BBC News understands that at least two of the boats refused to be rescued by the French Coast Guard, as they wanted to be picked up in British waters so they would be taken to the UK. Another 22 migrants were rescued by the French and are being treated in hospital for hypothermia. This is the third such major incident in the English Channel this month. Refugee charities report that human traffickers are using January's Brexit deadline to encourage more people to take their chances. Natalie Elphick is the Conservative MP for Dover and Deal and says the French in particular need to do more to stem the flow.
More local activity on the French side is essential, but also action which is being led by the National Crime Agency to tackle the international people trafficking operation, these organised crime gangs that are behind this trade in people.
Last week, Mrs. Elphick met the Home Secretary, who told her more action would be taken to stem the flow of migrants.
Jonathan Josephs. For the past 6 months, Hong Kong has been rocked by huge anti-government demonstrations, which have often led to violent clashes between the police and hardcore protesters. But the pro-democracy movement also has a musical side, with millions of people in Hong Kong turning their backs on the Chinese national anthem and instead embracing a new song called Glory to Hong Kong, as Nick Beek reports.
The firing of tear gas. The charging of riot police. The chanting of the defiant. The sounds of Hong Kong in 2019. But there was something else that emerged from the smoke and fire. A new soundtrack to the city.
I've always had this idea to write a theme song for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. A theme song that echoes with the footsteps and heartbeats of the freedom fighters.
Glory to Hong Kong was the first classical piece of music 25-year-old Thomas had ever written.
As a musician, I think I can provide them with more than helmets or umbrellas, more than physical equipment. I think a song, an idea is bulletproof.
This is the official video, recorded by an orchestra dressed in black, wearing gas masks and yellow helmets, the uniform of the protesters. Within days of its release, Glory to Hong Kong was being performed everywhere. In the street. In shopping centres. Football stadiums. Can you just tell us a little bit about the lyrics, what you wanted to achieve?
There are four stanzas in the song. And the first stanza talks about why we refuse to surrender when all the freedom, fairness has been taken away. And the second stanza summarizes that the movement. We march on despite all the blood along the way. And then the third stanza stands out from the others. It's a bit different. It is reminding everyone that we need to hold on to our beliefs even in the darkest hours. And then the last paragraph looks into the future.
For many, Glory to Hong Kong had encapsulated their fight.
I lost my voice a little.
We met Kelly and Sharon studying in the park.
I remember my first time hearing the song that I cry a little because they fight for our freedom for the five demands, and I'm really proud of them.
The first time it made you cry, but now when you sing it, people sing it all the time. How does it touch you when you sing?
We feel really excitement. We are connected with this song.
It brings you together.
Yes.
What do you think the legacy of your song may be? What will people say about it in the future?
Of course, it's a little bit too early to say, but I think it worked well in uniting all the people and boost their morale, and also to make them have a new identity as a Hong Kong person. That's the legacy.
Nick Beek talking to Thomas, composer of Glory to Hong Kong. He's never given his full name publicly because of fear of reprisals from pro-Beijing supporters. The British military has stepped in to help in the fight against poaching in southern Africa. After 3 months of preparation, troops helped move more than a dozen endangered black rhinos from South Africa to Malawi. Riley Carlson has the story.
It was a journey of about 2,000 kilometres from KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa by land and air to Lwande National Park in Malawi. 17 endangered black rhinos were moved in one of the largest ever relocations of the species. John Scanlon is the special envoy to the conservation organisation African Parks.
It's a matter of actually, if you like, spreading your risk. Leave some where they are, but you relocate some to other locations that are secure, where rhinos were originally found, and then we have much better chance of seeing them into the future.
At the end of a three-month training mission to combat poaching in Malawi, the soldiers from the 2nd Battalion Royal Gurkha Rifles helped release the rhinos into the park. They also worked with locals to make sure the park was secure and the animals would be protected.
Poaching has surged over recent years, and it's a major threat to the black rhino. We're using good technology to know where the animals are, very good relations with surrounding communities and with the Malawian government, so very good conditions for releasing these animals.
These rhinos are targeted for their horns, which are then sold on the black market. Conservation officials estimate that only around 5,500 black rhinos are left on the planet.
Riley Carlson reporting. And still to come in the podcast.
Und der wilde Knabe brach's Rüßlein auf der Heiden. Rüßlein wehrte sich und stach, half ihm doch.
We look back at the life of one of the leading tenors of the last century, Peter Schreier, who's died at the age of 84. In April 2017, Turkey blocked access to Wikipedia after entries on the website suggested that Turkish officials were involved in oil trading with so-called Islamic State militants in Syria. The ban cited a law relating to material that is obscene or a threat to national security. On Thursday, Turkey's highest court ruled it was unconstitutional. Wikipedia's parent organisation, the Wikimedia Foundation, has also been pursuing the case through the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. Chan Yegintsu is its lead counsel.
Today's judgment is a welcome ruling for Wikimedia, but it doesn't mean that the proceedings that are still afoot before the European Court of Human Rights automatically go away. I mean, we'll have to wait to see and consider closely the judgment of the Turkish Constitutional Court, see the scope of its findings on the law, on the facts and on remedies.
Well, Başak Çala is a professor of international law at the Hertie School in Berlin and a visiting professor of law at Koç University in Istanbul. She spoke to my colleague Julian Marshall about the judgment.
I think this ruling was expected. The Turkish Constitutional Court in 2004 ruled on blanket bans on Twitter and YouTube before. So the Wikipedia case is not a different case from the previous cases. So I think this was a very expected judgment. But it has come very, very delayed because the ban on Wikipedia was about 2.5 years ago. And in previous bans on Twitter and on YouTube, the court reacted within 10 days or within 45 days. So I think the surprise bit is why the court has waited for 2.5 years to rule on a blanket ban, not a very complicated legal case as such.
Is the Constitutional Court seen as independent and impartial inside Turkey?
I think it's becoming very, very difficult to answer that question. When the Turkish Constitutional Court's individual petition system was established in 2012, there was a lot of excitement about this Constitutional Court remedy to improve human rights protections in Turkey. And in the first couple of years, people really evaluated this court in a very positive light. But as the democratic protections and the rule of law and the human rights situation deteriorated in Turkey, the Turkish Constitutional Court wasn't able to stand up to these violations in a timely way, like it hasn't done so in Wikipedia, or in an effective way. So there are now a lot more skeptical voices about the Turkish Constitutional Court's responses. And a lot of critical commentary would say that the Turkish Constitutional Court is very selective in which it delivers justice. In highly politically sensitive issues, it delays cases or it decides against applicants. But in other more routine cases, it actually does deliver pretty good judgments.
More generally, though, how robust are human rights protections, including but not only the right to freedom of expression under the existing Turkish constitution?
Now, the Turkish constitution on paper has very robust protections for freedom of expression, also for journalistic freedom and protection of journalists. But what we see at the moment is that these protections seem to be just on paper. What we see in the practices of the prosecutors and the practices of the judges is that they're not respecting the constitutional protections concerning freedom of expression. Turkey has the highest number of freedom of expression cases before the European Court of Human Rights, and the Turkish Constitutional Court also receives a very significant number of freedom of expression cases itself. And sometimes the Turkish Constitutional Court offers good protection in those cases, and sometimes it doesn't. The reason that there are so many cases before the Turkish Constitutional Court is because the lower courts are not respecting the constitutional protections. And the Turkish Constitutional Court has in the past struggled to get its judgments implemented as well.
Başak Çala, visiting professor at Koç University in Istanbul. Now to the story of Riley Howell, a 21-year-old American college student who died along with a classmate when a gunman opened fire at the University of North Carolina in April. Four other students were injured, but police said at the time that Riley's actions prevented more injuries or loss of life. Riley Howell was also a Star Wars fan, and at the time of his death, Lucasfilm, the production company behind the Star Wars franchise, wrote to his family to express their condolences. Now the company has recognised Riley as a posthumous Jedi Master, a well-known group in the Star Wars films with the name Riley Howells. Julian Marshall has been speaking to his mother, Natalie.
Well, as far as we know, from the investigation, once the shooter came to the door and started shooting, Riley was facing the door and he started shooting classmates, and Riley got up and went behind, there was a column in the room, and went behind a column in the room, like took some steps back and got behind a column. And this is all, you know, within a minute, it all happened so fast, and charged the shooter and tackled him. And while he was charging, was fatally wounded. So shot several times. And after Riley tackled the gunman, no one else was shot. So he was lauded for that action.
And this must be a very difficult time of the year for you, your first Christmas without him.
It is. And his birthday is also in December. His birthday is December 13th. So, yes, December has been especially hard.
And a time when you probably are remembering him even more.
Yes. the Christmas mornings, and he would come down and he would be the first one, and he would gather up his siblings and they would come downstairs and we would have our celebration. It was different this year, and it was difficult.
What you've missed out in your memories of Riley is the fact that he was such a Star Wars fan.
Yes, I can't begin to tell you what a Star Wars fan he was. I was home with Riley when he was a toddler. We would just have the Star Wars movies running in the background while we did things. It just took with him. And well, I grew up loving Star Wars. Let me start with that. I'm a big fan. And so I passed that along to him. And so when he was little, we just had the VCR with the VHS taped, and he'd watch the lightsaber scenes and act them out and jump around, and collected all of the books, especially the one he's in, the DK books, were his favorite, the encyclopedias of the Star Wars galaxy.
You went to see the latest Star Wars movie, The Rise of Skywalker, on the opening night, and I don't know how to put this, but you effectively took Riley with you.
We did, and we would not have missed it, and we would not want him to miss it. He was with us in spirit, is what I'm going to say, and we had an honorary seat for him, and we put his ashes right there, and we just imagined that he was, as a Force ghost, right there with us watching it.
You're pleased with this announcement, are you, from Lucasfilms, this honor that they've accorded to Riley?
Well, you know, we were shocked when we got the letter when all this happened. But it was just an envelope with gold writing on it that appeared one day in May, and we were stunned. So we didn't know how it would come to be. It was a condolence letter from Lucasfilm, and then they said that later in the year he would appear somehow in a publication, and I didn't hear anything else from them, and they didn't tell us anything, and then it just appeared. And we are humbled by it, and I don't know how else to say it. That Riley would have been his beloved series that he's become part of it. Yes, we are pleased.
So it would have meant a lot to Riley himself, you'd think.
I do think, and well, not. I don't just think. I know that we've had so many people reach out and do things for us, and just let us know they're with us in this walk. And you know, the fan relations team at Lucasfilm, they didn't have to do this. And it was one of the few things that brought a smile to our children's faces in the weeks after, just knowing that his selflessness and his courage was going to be remembered in a different sort of way than how we took it in. And I think Riley, actually, once he heard about it, he would want to know, he would be intrigued as to how he fit into other parts of the story, how it all overlaps, because that's what he liked when he was a little one, was, you know, just learning the facts and knowing. He just had like the encyclopedic knowledge about it, so he would want to figure out what his place was in the Star Wars universe exactly.
Natalie Henry Howell talking to Julian Marshall. For the first time in many years, Christians in Sudan were able to celebrate freely this Christmas. The sound of a church in Khartoum. Christmas was even made an official holiday, and Sudan's Minister of Religious Affairs apologised to the Christian community for the unjust and clumsy policies they'd endured under former President Omar al-Bashir, who was overthrown earlier this year. I heard more from our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
Between 2011, which is when South Sudan, which is predominantly Christian, broke away, became independent from Sudan, and this year, basically all Christian public holidays, including Christmas, were just stopped by the government of former President Omar al-Bashir. And he also introduced other measures such as banned the construction of new churches, basically made life for the small minority of Christians in Sudan really impossible. They just weren't allowed to worship. So this is a pretty big thing that now they've been allowed to celebrate Christmas again. And there've been pictures of Sudanese Christians in the markets with Christmas trees and things like that. So it's like they're allowed to openly express their religion again after 8 years.
And not only allowed, there's actually been an apology.
Yes, there has. It's pretty extraordinary because Sudan has been known for being such a sort of traditional, pretty harsh, often Islamist kind of system of rule. And the Minister of Religious Affairs, he actually issued a serious apology. He described the policies of former President Omar al-Bashir as unjust on Christians. And then he went on to list a whole series of abuses that have been conducted against Christians, such as harm to Christians themselves, destruction of their churches, theft of their property. So it was really a pretty heartfelt and significant apology.
Yeah, this change is a result of the fall of the regime, the fall of Omar al-Bashir, that deal between the military who took over and the civilian protesters. I mean, how different is life in Sudan this Christmas from last Christmas?
Well, I mean, it is obviously people can breathe politically. They have got space now after that extraordinary revolution that happened that ended up in the overthrow of President Omar al-Bashir. But still, there are people who kind of spearheaded that revolution who are saying not enough progress has been made. So there are certain gestures like these ones to do with the Christians and allowing Christmas to take place again in Sudan. But there's still an enormous amount of political, economic and social change that needs to be implemented in Sudan before the leaders of the revolution will really feel that what they did actually has had any long-lasting effect. It's still very early days.
Mary Harper. We end this edition of the podcast with the sound of the celebrated German tenor Peter Schreier. He died on Christmas Day at the age of 84. In a career that spanned decades and encompassed more than 60 different roles, Peter Schreier performed regularly in some of the world's most prestigious opera houses and festivals, from Berlin, Vienna and Salzburg to New York and Milan. He once said that a day without music is a wasted day. Here he is singing one of Schubert's songs, Little Rose on the Heath.
Und der wilde Knabe brach's Rüßlein auf der Heiden. Rüßlein wehrte sich und stach, half ihm doch kein Wie und Ach, muss es eben leiden.
The voice of Peter Schreier, who has died at the age of 84. And that's all from us for now. But there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.